Thor, Norse god of thunder. A fearless warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Thor, Norse god of thunder. A fearless warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Two arch enemies battle to the death. Thor, the thunder god, against a staggering beast. A giant snake who strikes with lethal force. It is man versus monster. Thor unleashes his deadliest weapon, lightning from his magic hammer, as thunder rocks heaven and earth. The myth of Thor is filled with these epic showdowns, heroic battles against creatures who threaten mankind.
Thor is a champion of the gods. He's the great fighter who can be brought out when something is really bad. You don't go to Thor for wisdom. Go to Thor because he's going to protect you against the evil monsters.
Tales of Thor's adventures provided escape from one of the bleakest periods in human history, the Dark Ages of the first millennium AD. It was a time when the Norse world, stretching from the British Isles to the Baltic Sea, was in turmoil.
It's an agricultural society where people were farming and surviving kind of at the very edge of how it was possible to survive because it was cold. It was the northern part of Europe. It wasn't around the Mediterranean where it was much easier to grow things. And it tended to be, from everything we can tell, quite violent.
War, famine and death were daily facts of life on the desolate northern fringes of Europe. But the myth of Thor brought a sense of order to the chaos.
It was a religion of the countryside. Paganism actually is a Latin word that describes that, what the country people believe in. And paganism is not really well organized either. It's not like the Greek pantheon in the sense that it's very well organized and everybody knows whose responsibilities and who's more important than whom. It's very different.
The view of human life in that mythology was a fairly dark, a fairly stern one. Human beings didn't look forward to the kind of salvation in heaven at the end of time that's promised in the Christian stories. They had a kind of a darker, a more sorrowful view of life. People have to show great courage and hardiness in the face of enormous obstacles.
For inspiration, the people looked to Thor.
Thor was the quintessential hero. He was strong. Unlike some of the other gods, he was not deceptive. He was not treacherous. But he was steadfast. And as this hero figure, I think people could identify with him best.
In the myth, two of Thor's weapons help him conquer evil forces. A belt that doubles his strength, and a hammer that shoots lethal bolts of lightning. No matter how far Thor throws his trusty hammer, it will return to him like a boomerang. And each time thunder roars, it means Thor's hammer has struck a giant.
Thor is the master of lightning. And this is not uncommon in other mythologies. The obvious parallel here is Zeus in classical mythology, who is the thunder god.
The thunder and lightning god is the protector god. He's the strongest fighter, so he has that capability that Zeus has, the thunderbolt, the hammer for Thor, that can destroy the bad guys.
Thor's myth begins with his birth to two all-powerful parents.
His father is Odin, the god of the heavens, and his mother is Jord, which is earth. And so, in a sense, he is of the sky and of the earth, which makes him the perfect god for Middle-earth, for Midgard, where humans are.
In Norse mythology, the world is made up of three levels, all represented in a form quite familiar to the ancient Norse. A tree.
They used to make housing that roughly resemble American teepees. And the entire view of the cosmos by the Old Norse was really based on that construction of housing. You had a center pole that would hold up the walls. It would have been the skeletal structure of the house. It would have been the skeletal structure of the cosmos. So the small representing the large. That's one of the reasons why trees become so very important.
In the mythical tree's highest branches is Asgard, the dwelling place of the gods. At the opposite end, beneath the roots, is a cool, dark realm known as Hel. This is the land of the dead. And it's from this tradition that our word Hel originates. The middle of the tree is Midgard, the earth. A world inhabited by humans. This is Thor's domain. As the warrior god, it is his duty to destroy mankind's enemies in Midgard, the evil giants.
The giants represent chaos, they represent destruction. If an avalanche killed you, if an earthquake got you, or a flood or something else, it was the work of a giant. They represent all the things that could go wrong with a civilization that was really kind of on the edge of survival because of the climate, because of how dangerous it was.
One can imagine living, for example, in a valley in Norway and seeing as winter progressed the frost coming down from the valleys, sort of the frost giants, if you will. And then spring comes, and one can see that as being Thor battling back the frost giants back up the mountain. And we will be able to have order restored.
Today, echoes of Thor's mythical battles with the giants can still be heard in the forests and frigid plains that flank the North Sea. Throughout Scandinavia, mysterious stone memorials dot the landscape, dating back to the pagan era. They were erected between the 4th and 12th centuries AD to mark territory, record important events, and serve as tombstones for kings and warriors. They are called runestones, and they are the only clues left behind by a society that didn't write down its stories. On the stones are runic inscriptions, much like our Latin alphabet.
They sort of describe a piece of mythology or a piece of a story that we sometimes are lucky enough to have in written form.
There is one figure who features prominently in many of these inscriptions. The thunder god himself. Thor.
There are quite a number of cases in runestones where Thor's name is carved in the runes with something like, "May Thor bless these runes." They wanted his power to somehow come through and protect them.
In Norse myth, each god battles his own personal enemy from among the evil giants. The runestones reveal the identity of Thor's nemesis. giant who takes the form of a snake. The Midgard Serpent.
This is a snake that gets larger and larger, and it's foretold that it's going to help bring about the doom of the gods and the end of the universe. Snake fear is actually hardwired into us. It's cross-cultural, and the Old Norse picked up on that. Snakes are bad, and they're scary, and that's sort of just the background that you can then build good mythology out of.
According to the legend, the Midgard Serpent grows so huge it can stretch around the earth and envelop the world in chaos.
It was the Midgard Serpent that was circled entirely around Middle-earth as a symbol of the edge of the world, but also a symbol of the danger of going past that edge.
This is the ultimate adversary, one Thor is determined to vanquish. But victory will not come easy, even for a god.
This ongoing contest between Thor and the Midgard Serpent really represents the contest between the force that is protecting order, protecting the world of the gods and the world of men, against this ever-present threat of outside chaos that always is there to threaten to destroy us.
Order versus chaos. It is a classic theme that resonated in the harsh Norse world. In the myth of Thor, it is often conveyed with a sense of humor. In one part of the story, Thor wants to get close to the Midgard Serpent without being detected. So he transforms himself into a young boy and asks an ogre named Hymir to take him fishing at sea.
And they go out deep and deep, deeper and deeper and further and further out and further and further out. And finally Hymir says, well, I think this is far enough. And Thor says, no, no, we can go further out yet.
Off the coast, Thor reveals his true identity and lures the serpent to the surface with the head of an ox.
And he throws the entire ox head with a giant hook in it over the side. Well, the Midgard Serpent bites on it, and Thor hauls it up. And so this gigantic Midgard Serpent is now sticking its head out of the water. And Thor is excited about this. He's thrilled. He's reaching for his hammer. He's like, now I've finally got you. But Hymir, the giant who's in the boat, is terrified.
As Thor raises his hammer to strike, the ogre cuts the fishing line. And the serpent dives back into the sea. Thor is enraged. He has lost a rare chance to kill his archenemy.
So Thor keeps having these encounters with the Midgard Serpent. Sometimes it's disguised, sometimes someone interferes. But in each case, the serpent gets away. And that's probably because the serpent is being saved in some way or another for the final battle between Thor and the Midgard Serpent.
This is not the only myth that features a clash between a thunder god and a giant serpent. It is a theme found in every corner of the ancient world. In the Hindu holy book of Vedas, there is a fight between the storm god Indra and a monstrous snake. And in Greek mythology, a serpentine beast named Typhon battled Zeus, the god of lightning. These myths were created thousands of miles apart and thousands of years apart, but they all tell essentially the same story. A god of thunder and lightning, out to destroy a serpent who threatens the world. But how could so many different societies have shared the same myth? It is likely they emerged from common experience. Could the serpent in these stories be based on a real sea monster? And if so, does that creature still prowl the depths of our oceans today? Surprising evidence suggests it just might. The Midgard Serpent, arch enemy of almighty Thor. A snake so colossal, it can wrap itself around the planet. In the myth, it represents chaos and evil in the world. But what could have inspired such a terrifying creature? Sightings of giant sea serpents have been reported for centuries. In the old Norse sagas, which are thought to be based on real history, there are even tales of ships being capsized by the beasts.
They often describe a gigantic creature with long tentacles that could reach out and snatch down ships and drag them to the bottom. This was often referred to as the Kraken.
The Kraken was said to have a long, slithery body that moved at lightning speed, just like the Midgard serpent. But tales of monstrous sea snakes aren't limited to Northern Europe. They can also be found in ancient Greece's most famous adventure story, the Odyssey. It describes a massive serpent with a taste for human flesh. The Scylla.
Scylla is this terrifying sea monster with many heads and many arms who, you know for a fact, will grab up six of your men and eat them.
Scylla. Kraken. The Midgard serpent. Are these mythical sea monsters coincidence, or could they be based on something real? A chance discovery in the 19th century teased that possibility. Fishermen in the North Atlantic encountered a massive unknown sea creature and succeeded in capturing it. The longest tentacle measured 35 feet. It was a giant squid.
The amazing thing is that nobody had actually been able to prove the existence of a giant squid up until the 1870s, when finally, after countless reports of these things by sailors who were never really believed, finally dozens of them washed into the shore in Newfoundland, proving that there really were these amazing creatures.
1,000 years earlier, tales of these sea monsters terrified Scandinavia's most rugged seafarers. Roving bands of marauders who built an empire by dominating the waves. The Vikings.
The word Viking itself means to plunder, to raid. And so the name that was applied to these people refers to the actual act of what they were doing.
When the fear of giant sea creatures threatened their voyages, the Vikings looked to one god, Thor.
We would have to imagine the Norsemen getting into their ships for plunder in the North Sea and praying to Thor for protection to help guide them to where they were going. So Thor took on certain kind of significance that elevated him above the other gods in the eyes of the warriors.
Viking raiders performed a special ritual in Thor's honor to guarantee their safety on the high seas.
The ritual involved dismantling a temple dedicated to Thor and taking the pillars of the temple onto the boats with them and dropping them over the side into the ocean in order to show that Thor was dominating the ocean, that they, as Thor's servants, were going to be able to have safe passage.
The pillars cast into the sea were usually cut from oak trees. Oak had a special connection to the thunder god. It was the wood most often struck by lightning. In fact, the central place to worship Thor was not a temple or a church. It was a tree known as Thor's Oak, and it was the Mecca of the ancient Norse world.
We are told that this oak signifies Thor. They would call up on that oak as, maybe even as if it were Thor himself.
For generations, Thor's Oak was the scene of bloody pagan sacrifices. His followers frequently left offerings of flesh at its base.
Oftentimes the sacrifice was in connection with ensuring that harvest and agriculture and things of this nature would be good for the following year. During particularly bad times, it was claimed that 9 of every animal would be sacrificed. And sometimes in really bad years, then you would even sacrifice a human being.
But we have enough evidence that there were sacrifices or executions associated with paganism and pagan sites, and it's no stretch of the imagination to think that they would have taken place at Thor's Oak also.
According to legend, Thor's Oak stood here in the town of Fritzlar, Germany, until 723 AD. That was the year everything changed. When the forces of another religion arrived from the south, determined to convert all non-believers. They set their sights on the symbolic center of the pagan world, Thor's Oak.
During the conversion of the Norse, Saint Boniface came. He gathered people together and says, if Thor exists, if he's so powerful, then surely he'll strike me down if I cut down his great tree. The Christian account says that a mighty wind then came and knocked the tree down, and when people saw this, they perceived it as a miracle, and they converted on the spot.
The fall of Thor's Oak was a symbolic turning point in Northern Europe. To the pagan faithful, it was as if Thor himself was falling. But it would take far more than this to make them surrender. The pagans had their own symbol to counter the Christian cross, Thor's magical hammer. In the myth, Thor uses it to strike down those who challenge his authority. But what if the thunder god were to lose his most treasured weapon? The consequences for both Thor and mankind would be devastating. In the myth, this is precisely what happened. For centuries, Thor's hammer was a symbol of power and pride in the pagan world. In the myth, it shoots lightning and helps Thor vanquish giant monsters.
The hammer is so important because it separates humans from everything else, and it gives power that you have from tools, power that you couldn't have with only your bare hands, no matter how strong they were. And that's really important about Thor. As strong as he is, he still needs his hammer.
In one pivotal story, the thunder god loses his prized weapon. Without it, he is powerless to take on the giants that threaten the earth. And the fate of humankind hangs in the balance. In the palace of Valhalla, sanctuary of the Norse gods, a ghastly ogre king quietly invades Thor's bedchamber and steals his hammer. The ogre knows that without it, Thor is helpless. And he plans to use it as blackmail.
When his hammer gets stolen, that's a stripping away of that human level of culture and technology that separates you out from the animals.
So Thor wakes up one morning, gropes around, discovers that he is missing his hammer. So who does he go to first? Strangely enough, he goes to Loki.
Loki is Thor's servant, but he is also a god. He is crafty, conniving, and says he knows exactly who stole the hammer. He sets out for the land of the ogres to get it back. There, Loki meets with the ogre king, Thrym, and the king names his price.
And Thrym, the giant, says, I have taken Thor's hammer and I've hidden it, and no one will find it unless they give me Freya as a bride. Freya, of course, is this beautiful, sensuous goddess of love, fertility, and sex, and the giants, the dwarves, everybody wants her.
Freya is also Thor's sister. When she hears what the ogre wants, she refuses to surrender. But something must be done to get Thor's hammer back.
Well, his hammer is one of his identifying features. His hammer is what he uses in order to kill the giants. Without his hammer, the gods are in trouble. The people are in trouble. Everyone's in trouble without Thor's hammer.
The gods call a special meeting to discuss the crisis. They agree on a risky strategy. To dress Thor up as his sister and send him as the bride instead.
We'll put the bridal gown on him, put the veil over him, and we will send him down disguised as Freya. And then perhaps he can get the hammer and come back. Thor is very upset at this. Thor is the super macho, uber masculine god, and was not about to, you know, go in drag.
But Thor has no other choice. He gives in and puts on Freya's bridal outfit. Only his red eyes are visible beneath the veil.
Well, now this is very comical, isn't it? Here we have the big macho god who's going to now dress in women's clothes. What exactly is Thor's hammer? It is the symbol of his masculinity, and in a sense, it's also a phallic symbol. And of course, Thor's now lost this symbol of his masculinity, and so now he has to become the opposite. He has to become a woman because he's no longer able to be a man.
With Loki at his side, Thor heads for the land of the giants. The Thunder God is not the most radiant bride. But to get back his precious hammer, he must swallow his pride.
Thrym sees them coming and says, "Ah, Freya, the only thing lacking in my world is Freya, and here she comes." So the first thing they do is have a party, and Thor eats all the food. And then, of course, she drinks all of the beer.
Thor's binge immediately raises suspicions. How can a blushing bride be such a drinker?
And Loki says, "Oh, no, don't worry about it. The bride just traveled for 8 days and nights. She's really, really thirsty."
But when Thrym takes a closer look at his bride-to-be, he notices that her eyes are red and fiery.
Thrym jumps back and says, "What's going on with Freya's eyes?" And Loki, again, quick with the answer, says, "Oh, well, she hasn't slept in a week either. She was so excited to get here. She so much wanted to get here." "Okay," says Thrym.
Finally, the king is convinced and hands the magic hammer to his bride. In an instant, the hammer fully restores Thor's power. The Thunder God is back with a vengeance. This is the myth, but what is the reality? As Christian armies fought their way north in the first millennium AD, the Norse drew inspiration from this story of Thor's resurgence.
When Christianity was being forced upon people, the idea of Thor and the symbolism of Thor presented some kind of pagan resistance movement to the overambitious attempts to baptize people.
The Christians had the upper hand in wealth, weapons, and men. But the pagans were prepared to fight to the death. The stage was set, the battle lines drawn. The armies of Christ would take on the followers of Thor for the souls of Northern Europe. The armies of Christ against the followers of Thor. The prize, control of Northern Europe. This is not a mythical showdown. It actually happened. For 300 years in the Dark Ages, kings and chieftains across the continent collided on the battlefield. Gradually, the Christians fought their way north into pagan Scandinavia. By the 11th century AD, the front lines reached the Swedish kingdom of Uppsala, home to some of the last surviving followers of Thor. There, every 9 years, the pagan faithful engaged in a bizarre and bloody ritual to honor the thunder god.
At this time, both men and animals were sacrificed to Thor, and their carcasses were hung up around the temple and in the trees. It's quite a grisly ritual.
In the late 11th century, this practice was challenged by Sweden's new king, a Christian named Inge the Elder. When Inge came to power, most of his subjects still worshipped Thor. But he was determined to change that.
He enforced Christianity and ended the sacrifice of horses and other animals and forbid the pagan rites. And his people did not like this very much.
Among the pagan holdouts in Inge's kingdom was his own brother, Blot-Sven. He seized on the religious unrest and made a play for power.
And we see this clash between them, where we have the Christian brother trying to impose Christianity, but his pagan brother driving the Christian brother into exile.
Initially, the pagans succeeded. But a few years later, Inge regained the upper hand with a surprise attack on the pagan temple. By force and fire, Thor's followers were defeated, and the Christians claimed Sweden. Conflicts like this occurred in kingdoms throughout Northern Europe. Today, the scars of these clashes can still be seen. In the Swedish town of Uppsala, there is a Christian church with foundations that date back to the 11th century, the same period when King Inge burned down the pagan temple. The church may even have been built directly over the ashes of that temple, as a symbol of Christianity's triumph.
People who are used to going to those places to celebrate their old religions will now come to the same places and celebrate the new religion. And that was in line with what had happened all across the area when the conversion to Christianity came.
Adjacent to the Christian church, there is a series of pagan burial mounds dating back to the Dark Ages. It's believed that this is the largest pre-Christian gravesite in Sweden. Mounds like these can still be found throughout Scandinavia. Many have been excavated, and they often turn up an unmistakable symbol of Thor. Small hammer amulets. They were often cast in bronze and worn around the neck.
These amulets are identifying markers that either I still believe in Thor or weren't as sort of a representation of trying to evoke the power of these gods in particular circumstances.
These artifacts demonstrate the power of Thor's myth in the ancient Norse world. To the Norse, Thor's appeal was in his humanity. He was a god, but he also had weaknesses. He possessed strength and courage, but also uncontrollable rage. And just like humans, Thor struggled with his own limitations.
He's not always the brightest. He is strong and brave and courageous, and he defends mankind. But he can be deceived. And usually the things that deceive him are the same things that deceive us.
In the myth, Thor's shortcomings are revealed in his struggles with the giants, who symbolize an unconquerable foe, the wrath of nature.
Nature was very much a threatening force. Nature was the thing that could betray you. Nature was what was out to get you.
So all of these stories are meant to show Thor as the champion of man, but even in the face of forces of nature, he will lose.
In one story, an ogre king named Utgard Loki seeks to humiliate Thor. So he assigns him three impossible tasks, each secretly tied to the forces of nature. The first challenge is to drink a horn full of ale. It seems easy enough, until Thor tries it.
And he drinks with all his might, and he seems to be barely able to change the level of the ale in the horn. He's very surprised and a bit embarrassed about this. After all, you know, a god as lusty as Thor ought to be able to down at least one horn of ale.
The thunder god has failed his first task. And the next is even tougher. Thor is told to lift the paw of a giant cat.
And so Thor says, oh, of course I can. He's trying to lift this cat off of the ground. He can barely get one paw off of the ground. Now this is getting embarrassing. If you can't lift a cat, what is wrong?
Strike two. Perhaps Thor is not so powerful after all. With his reputation on the line, the Thunder God faces his final challenge. He must wrestle a feeble old woman.
Utgard Loki, again laughing, and the other giants laughing at Thor's discomfiture, says, well, we'll try an easy one then. Here is this old lady. Can you wrestle an old lady and beat her in a fight?
As he prepares to pounce, Thor is overpowered. The ogre's plan has worked. Thor is humiliated. The king now reveals his secret.
Utgard Loki explains what's happened. Thor, you were drinking from a horn, but the horn was set into the sea, so there was no way you could drink from the entire sea. Secondly, I asked you to pick up my cat. Well, the cat was the Midgard serpent. Who can pick up something that rings the earth? And thirdly, I asked you to fight with my grandmother. Well, that wasn't just my grandmother. That was old age. And who can defeat old age? None of us can.
Thor flies into a rage when he discovers the trick. But the king instantly vanishes into thin air.
Utgard the Loki has used magic to trick Thor. This story shows the contest between Thor's brute strength and the giant's dark magical powers.
To the ancient Norse, this story demonstrated that even the gods can't overcome the awesome power of nature. According to Norse belief, Thor would battle nature's evil ogres until the end of time. Then, one final epic clash would unfold between the forces of order and chaos. It would be called Ragnarok, the Viking Armageddon. As Ragnarok's apocalyptic events unfold, the entire earth will erupt in tremors. The sun will darken, and a bitter winter will grip the earth for 3 full years.
Not only will, you know, fire begin to consume everything, but mountains will begin to fall into the sea. There will be great earthquakes and terrible floods.
Ragnarok paints a grim picture of mankind's final fate. But it isn't entirely unique. Many cultures throughout the ages have predicted a catastrophic doomsday. Nostradamus, the ancient Maya, even the Romans. And there is one ancient text that predicts an eerily similar end of days, the Bible's Book of Revelation.
The similarities between Revelations and Ragnarok are in the area of weather phenomena and monsters rising from the deeps and from the sky and the destruction of physical world and the bringing together of all the people who've ever existed, bringing their souls together and judging them.
Ironically, despite centuries of bloody conflict between Christians and pagans, their final prophecies are intertwined. But while the Christian and pagan apocalypse stories may have similarities, in one respect, they are dramatically different. In Ragnarok, the gods die. Ragnarok, the final chapter in Norse mythology. It is the ultimate clash between order and chaos.
Ragnarok is a great battle between the giants and the gods, and really all the bad guys and all the good guys.
Everything is brought into disarray. Everything is brought into chaos. And every god meets his antithesis in his opposite. It is a cataclysmic battle. Everything that would be normative in the world will be turned upside down.
This seismic clash will culminate in a long-awaited showdown. The thunder god, Thor, against his arch nemesis, the Midgard Serpent.
Thor's been itching to fight this Midgard serpent ever since it was created, and finally he gets his chance. This time there's nobody interfering. It's just straight up mayhem between the two of them. The Midgard serpent wraps its coils around Thor and squeezes the life out of him, but Thor has on his belt, which gives him the extra strength, the power that he needs to even lift his own hammer, and so he's able to break free of the coils.
After a vicious back and forth struggle, Thor lands a fatal blow. But in a cruel twist of fate, he is exposed to the lethal venom that drips from the serpent's wound. Thor will pay the ultimate price for his victory, his life.
So these two arch adversaries who have been at each other throughout the mythic cycle finally destroy each other, and we have the meeting of chaos and order canceling each other out.
According to the myth, when Ragnarok unfolds, the world as we know it will come to a terrifying end. All the gods, giants, and most of mankind will die along with Thor.
In the aftermath of this, the only thing that survives is the World Tree. And within it, a man and a woman have hidden. The grass grows again, and they meet on the plain where Asgard had been, and they set about creating a new cosmos.
A Viking Adam and Eve. Strangely, the end of Norse myth bears a striking resemblance to the beginning of the Bible. But this is more than a coincidence. When the Ragnarok myth was finally written down in the 13th century, Christianity was already firmly rooted in Northern Europe. To help sway Europe's pagans, Christian missionaries made Norse mythology a prequel to the Old Testament. The Norse gods die, and Adam and Eve are born.
We can see Ragnarok as looking at the end of the pagan world. And obviously after this great devastating and destructive event, then a new world can come and Christianity will arrive.
So even though this is the doom of the gods, they kind of wipe the slate clean. Now there's a fresh start in a paradisical world. And in this beautiful world, there's a chance to start fresh and to do things properly and to be good. This was a way that you could get the Old Norse as the backstory and get it to mesh with the Christian idea that there was an Adam and Eve and a beginning and so forth.
As Christianity consumed the Norse world, the followers of Thor went underground for good.
The cult of Thor seemed to fade as the Christian conversion of the North began to really take hold. The conversion itself took centuries to really fully penetrate to everyday custom and belief. So the slow sunset for Thor's religion.
Centuries after the Christian conversion, Thor's legacy quietly lives on. The fifth day of the week, Thursday, is named after him. It is Thor's Day, and he endures in popular culture as a comic book and movie hero. But centuries ago, Thor was far more than a footnote from a lost religion. He was the divine protector of the world's most terrifying warriors.
Now, isn't that a lot better than a Jew on a stick of failure and death and nonsense that he's coming back? No, this to me is a great allegory to the final struggle between our race and the Abrahamic religions that are the snake, the serpent, that entwined Thor. And he was about to have his life crushed out of him. In other words, the defeat of the race. But he had his magical belt buckle, and he destroyed the serpent. Anyhow, I like those kind of things. And nature, too. Nature, the all-powerful situation. Great God, nature. That's where it's at. Chaos and order at the same time. I mean, on different sides. Chaos and order. That's nature. And nature's about to kick our ass. We are going to get our ass kicked big time. It's already started. Anyhow, this is White Aryan Resistance. White Aryan Resistance. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Yeah. I forgot I had that particular soundtrack, but I really like it. I hope you liked it, too. And it is the 4th of August, 2015. August for Augustus, Caesar Augustus. We got Thor, we got all these pagan names for our weeks and months. That's great. They're probably going to try to take those away one of these days, but I don't think they're going to get it done, at least not for a long time. And you should be bringing your kids up on this type of Norse mythology and so forth. Especially both the boys and the girls, but especially the boys. That's what we need today. That is what we need today. And I know the Christians cry about it. Oh, all this pagan stuff is coming back. All this pagan movies and pagan this. I love it. I love it. Well, let's have a little bit more from our pessimist guide to history. 1226 BC, first known eruption of Mount Etna. Though the 1226 BC eruption of Mount Etna, located on the island of Sicily, was the first on record, it was by no means the last. Europe's largest volcano erupted again in 1170 BC, 1149 BC, and 525 BC, and at intervals thereafter up to the present day. 612 BC, destruction of Nineveh. The ancient Assyrian capital Nineveh was surrounded by massive walls, said to have been 60 feet thick. Wow! And 100 feet high. From this imposing fortified city, Assyrian kings ruled over a great empire until the reign of Sardanapalus. During this period, a coalition of Babylonian Medes and Chaldeans began a rebellion against Sardanapalus to end the Assyrian rule. For 2 years, the rebel armies fought against the Assyrian forces, but could not penetrate the walls of Nineveh. Sardanapalus felt safe because an oracle had assured the Assyrian king that Nineveh would not fall until the river Tigris became its enemy. As luck would have it, the Tigris overflowed and its floodwaters knocked down a portion of the great wall surrounding the city. The rebels poured in through the breach, and in despair, Sardanapalus burned himself alive on a massive pyre in his palace. The fate of the oracle is not known. The victorious armies sacked and pillaged Nineveh, and then, out of the hatred for Assyrian rule, systematically destroyed and burnt the city, including its magnificent temples, palaces, and homes, a shining example of the ravages of war. And one more, ca. 600 BC, the terrible price of disobedience. When the Median ruler Astyages dreamed that his grandson would one day take over his throne, he ordered his servant Harpagus to kill the boy. It would appear that Astyages was a little lacking in self-confidence. Harpagus took pity, however, and gave the child to a herdsman whose own son had died. He brought to the king the corpse of the herdsman's son as proof that the deed had been done. But at the age of 10, the king's grandson was seen taking part in a game with other children in which he play-acted the part of the king. He was noticed and brought to his grandfather, who recognized him immediately. Practiced in the art of swift judgment, the king punished Harpagus in the most horrific way he could imagine. He invited the servant to dinner at the palace. Unknown to Harpagus, had Harpagus' own 13-year-old son killed and cooked. The king then served Harpagus, his son, for dinner. When the meal ended, the king presented Harpagus with a basket containing the boy's hands, feet, and head. One can easily imagine the shock, horror, and anger the servant must have felt. But so absolute was the obedience commanded by this king that Harpagus merely bowed, saying that whatever the king did must be right. Astyages could have given Attila the Hun lessons in the management of intimidation. And that's it for today's reading from A Pessimist History. And you thought ISIS was bad. ISIS is not bad. The people who lived long, long time ago were very bad when they wanted to be. And our race will become bad again. It is now, except it redirects its strength and power into stupid things like capitalist exploitation and taking over countries and so forth like that. With the people, the common people, not benefiting by it at all, and the other countries being enslaved. So that's not the kind of power anybody can do anything but fight against and destroy it. Let it fall. Well, we don't have too much time here, so we'll go back to Jack Nelson's book, The Terror in the Night, about our chaos. If much of what Hoover did in public smacked of image polishing, he was also quietly transforming the FBI in the South from a passive observer of the civil rights wrong struggle to an aggressive enemy of the Ku Klux Klan. He was doing it under pressure, of course, and he still had no use for Martin Luther King or the Civil Wrongs Movement, and would continue to try to discredit and undermine King. But now he began to redefine FBI's mission dramatically. He increased its resources and transferred scores of agents from around the country who had personal roots or work experience in the South. Let's get the South. Let's get those white people in the South. That was the rallying cry. And now it's let's get the white people wherever they're at. Except a few of the ruling class. Civil rights leaders worried about the sympathies of the new Southern agents. Many of the agents stationed in the South in earlier periods had developed close ties to the local officials they worked with and often shared their views. Martin Luther King, in a New York Times interview in 1962, had complained that the FBI agents in the South were mostly white Southerners who identified with the values of the communities they served. He said they were friendly with the local police and people who are promoting segregation, and adding that every time he saw agents in Albany, Georgia, they were with the local police force. Critics pointed out that King was wrong about Albany, that four of the five agents based there were Northern-born, even though they worked under a Southerner, Marion Cheek. However, complaints about the FBI, regardless of where the agents were from, often were valid even after the FBI declared war on the Klan in 1964. In one egregious case, the so-called Orangeburg Massacre on February the 8th, 1968, FBI agents were on hand as the South Carolina State Patrolman opened fire on protesting black students, killing three and injuring 27 others. Many of the students were running away when hit in the back. The agents told the Justice Department investigators that they were not present at the shooting because they did not want to be called to testify against the patrolman. On balance, though, the Southern FBI proved to be a powerful new tool against the Klan. Wait a minute here. Familiar with the region and its mores, able to speak its dialect and often helped by family ties and contacts, the Southern agents frequently were more effective than the Northerners in interviewing witnesses, developing information, informants, and working with the local law enforcement officers, like Southern-bred reporters covering the civil wrongs movement. The agents walked the talk and talked the talk of the South. Frank Watts, who was a native of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, found recruiting Klansmen as informants more difficult than his previous assignment, penetrating the KGB. Most of the Klansmen were Christian zealots who believed passionately in white supremacy and hated the FBI. But Watts' mother was a schoolteacher who had grown up in Jones County, home of Sam Bowers and the White Knights, and she helped her son identify a number of people in the Klan who turned out to be relatives or people he grew up with. I would go see these people and would gain entrance to their houses because I would say, "Hello from Annie Mae, my mother," thus using the good old boy routine. Remember this, boys and girls. You can't trust anybody completely. And that would get my foot in the door. And once you convinced one of them to cooperate, they would become stronger than any support person you ever imagined. Sort of reminds you of the Christian Bible thing, your enemy is in your own household. Before long, the Jackson FBI office had a strength of 250 agents and more, along with Jim Ingram, who became his chief assistant, was pushing his men at a killing pace. The caseload was running 2,000 to 2,500 cases a month. Well, I guess the Klan was involved in guerrilla warfare, one-fifth of them involving the Klan. Moore divided the office into five segments, giving Ingram the civil wrongs matters and keeping the Klan on his own desk. Most of the time, they worked 7 days a week, with half a day off on Sunday. Gee, they never worked that hard on the mob up in New York City, did they? From 6 in the morning, July 10th, when we opened... Oh, that's right. Hoover didn't believe there was a mob. Yeah, from 6 in the morning, July 10th, when we opened the office, to the end of the year, there were no days off. Half a day on Sunday to go to church. Moore remembered 6 a.m. to midnight. I think back and wonder how we did it. We were working at night on the bombings and the burnings of churches, Ingram recalled, but during the day we had to, at the instruction of the Justice Department, follow all demonstrations with thousands of protesters and photograph every incident, such as arrest, to make sure there was no brutality. evidently by the local police. Ingram, a big outgoing Oklahoman, 6 foot 3 inches tall and 230 pounds, looked like a professional football player. Outward amiable, he knew how to intimidate a Klansman. During the investigation of Vernon Dahmer's killing, he heard that a suspect was publicly boasting, "Any FBI man that steps on my property, I'm going to shoot him." When Ingram and another agent, Jim Awe, showed up at the man's house outside Laurel, he confronted them with a double-barrel shotgun and threat, "I'm going to shoot both of you men if you don't turn and run." Ingram, moving crab-like to his left towards the shelter of a tree, motioned for Awe to move to the right and then shouted, "We won't turn our back on you, and all we want is to talk with you about your whereabouts on the night Vernon Dahmer was killed." "Oh, yeah, come on in." "I'm going to tell you one more time to get off my property or I'm going to open fire. If you raise the barrel of that shotgun, we're armed and you can't kill us both. One of us will have to kill you." The Klansman began, and this is another thing, don't boast and brag and say how you're going to kill people. Don't ever do that. Don't go into a bar and start blowing off. It reminds me, and I've told this story many times, of a guy who was involved in a right-wing organization in the Los Angeles area. And not like the right-wingers today. Some of the right-wingers of the old days were tough-ass guys, a lot of them. Well, anyhow, this guy was, he's in a bar, he jumps up on the table or the bar in the place and yells, "But for me, give me liberty or give me death." And some guy shot him. Didn't kill him, but he shot him. So be careful what you're talking about, and don't brag about what you're going to do and all that kind of bullshit. That's for amateurs. "If you lay down your shotgun, we could talk peacefully and get this over with," Ingram said. Just then, the suspect's brother drove up in a pickup truck. "Let me talk with him just a minute," the brother said. The two men walked into the house. A few minutes later, the Klansman's brother came out. "I'm surprised my brother didn't shoot you, because he's probably the meanest of the Jones County bunch," he told the agents. "But I'll bring him to a place where you can talk to both of us. I'd appreciate it if you would leave, because Sam Bowers says Klansmen don't have to be interviewed on their property." The agents later interviewed the Klansman at his brother's house and concluded he was not involved in the Dahmer murder. But that confrontation and the way it was resolved set a precedent. Many members of the White Knights who were not involved in violent acts concluded the agents could not be intimidated and decided they would be better off agreeing to be interviewed. No, you weren't better off being interviewed. Answering questions by any of these people is suicide. The breakthrough on the interviews made it easier for Moore's agents to recruit Klansmen as informers. I think there were not enough of those informer Klansmen that met their maker. If there had been enough of them met their maker, that would have slowed that down real good. The right wing has never been good at that. They talk a lot about it. But people who betrayed the struggle and the right wing down through the years, almost none of them ever paid the price. Almost none of them. Some of the worst are still walking around the streets of the country. The core of the FBI's campaign against the Klan, it was a difficult, often risky game played by the no-holds-barred rules of an alley fight. As Ingram said, the informants themselves were rabid Klan followers. Serious, I would say. Many of them were the ones who started the claverns, and the agents, through Roy's direction, would just start pounding on them, working on them. It sounded mild enough, the way the Moore explained it. Our program was to identify a Klansman, do a background on him, enough that you knew enough about him, then interview him. Out of every 100 interviews, we came up with an informant. What motivated Klan informants? Well, one, we explained the facts of life. 2, money might be involved. 3, might be a threat against them that they didn't know about within the clan group itself. Well, that's why you organizations, it doesn't work out. See, they joined clan caverns, and they became known to each other and all that kind of stuff. The ones who didn't lasted the longest. Translated, explaining the facts of life meant threatening and frightening the prospective informant in every possible way. Klansmen were warned that the FBI was combing their personal and business affairs for any vulnerability, no matter how small.
We'll get you on a tax evasion.
Agents who often used information about Klansmen's private lives against them turned friend against friend, husband against wife, and wife against husband. And that's at the heart of COINTELPRO. Make sure you know everything you can about every Klansman, Moore instructed his men. Go back again and again if necessary to try to recruit somebody you think would make a good informant. If you learn he's involved in something, then you can use it against him and then use it again. The agents would try to win them over, but as Moore said, as last resort, we would hold something over them. Fear had a lot to do with it. Remember all this, boys and girls, because they never stop this kind of stuff. They do it all the time, and things heat up in this country, they'll be doing it more and more. The agents would try to win them over, but as Moore said, as a last resort, we would hold something over them. Oh, I read that. Klansmen were notorious for beating the hell out of their wives, which shows you a character flaw there. And the wives would complain to the FBI and request that their husbands be arrested. Instead, the agents would inform the Klansmen of their wives' complaints, generating pressure within the families that the FBI could exploit. Extramarital affairs were rampant among the Klansmen, and that's something, it's a very bad mistake if you're trying to carry on guerrilla warfare. Another area of vulnerability. They were always getting out of bed with their black paramour and then coming to talk with us. That's what bothered me, Moore said. As Tom wept, in other words, there's Klansmen bend down with nigger women at the same time they're supposedly fighting the FBI. They were always, let's see here. As Tom Webb put it in his Mississippi drawl, a lot of Klansmen used the Klan as an excuse to go off and screw some woman their wife wouldn't know where they were at. I ran into a few of those too when I was running the Klan in California. Too many people out there would recruit the wrong kind of people, and it was almost, and one of the big reasons I got out of the Klan was it was something you couldn't control. People who you put in charge 50 miles away or 20 miles away were recruiting people that were not good people, and they morally bad people. Yeah, they wanted to hate the niggers, hate the blacks, but they were living lives that were not much better themselves. I became disgusted with the Klan KKK of California in 1980. I left it. Webb leaned heavily on his own Southern background in recruiting informants. I'm a native Mississippian, he would tell them, and I was brought up just like you were, not to mix with negros. We didn't eat together, we didn't socialize together. I can understand just how you feel, but if you don't want to give the Justice Department reason to force changes even faster down here, you better leave the civil wrongs protesters alone and cooperate with me. What the Klan is doing is just bringing on more integration faster than if you ignored the civil wrongs movement. I think that's partially true. I think that many times the things that were being done made it worse faster. And it definitely forced a lot of the politicians to come down on the other side. And so I think so, too. I think that if a lot of people came out right now around the country and started shooting blacks or whatever, that it would not help our situation at all. It would make it worse. I think you'll find that it's the economy and things like that that are going to bring things to a head. Sometimes if a Klansman were in financial trouble or somebody in his family was sick and he was needing something, the FBI would offer a helping hand. Oh, yeah. Often the agents provided money, and they found that more persuasive than anything else. Well, that money came from the taxpayers. That money came from the Southern taxpayers. Ministers were among the best informants. There you go. Christian ministers were the best informants. Don't ever forget it. They believed segregation was part of Christianity, and they preached it from the pulpit. Yes, they did a lot down south, and also supported the slave owners on the big plantations. And they added so much more to the problem. They would use the Bible to show they were correct, said Ingram. I wouldn't use the Bible to prove anything other than how many pages were in it. We attended many rallies where they burned crosses and listened to the same messages over and over. And no doubt about it, they were spellbinders. They would incite a group ministers were looked up to. Well, you see, the problem is with ministers, though, there's a flaw in their whole story. All that mythology ends up being turned around on the people that, oh, well, Jesus said we're equal and all that kind of stuff. So if we're equal, well, why shouldn't my daughter go out with a black guy? No, Christianity is an enemy. It's an enemy to be feared and triumphed over. It took me many, many decades to learn that. And still, a lot of my problems from people on the right that go after me all the time, it's about religion. And if they don't have that religion, they create another religion, like worship Adolf Hitler or worship somebody else, or now it's going to be Trump for a while. You know, I'm getting a lot of stuff out of the South. They're all in it for Trump. The ruling class are not going to let a guy like Trump really change things. How many times have we been through this? I worked my ass off on third parties and people I thought were good people. I worked with George Wallace, took care of his headquarters there in Southern California and did all kinds of stuff. But he turned out to be a traitor too. I'll tell you. In their quest for informants, agents sometimes took hair-raising chances. Moore arranged for Frank. Well, I can understand down there in the South, especially down in there where those bayous, and so I've been back in those bayous, man. I was back in the bayou to a Klan deal one time, way down there by New Orleans, and I'm telling you, we were in the middle of nowhere, and there were alligators and everything around. And we didn't know where we were at. We just followed the leader out there. Frenchie Depew was the guy's name, as I recall. He owned a pig farm out there in the middle of the bayou. And so the funny thing about it was that they're going to have this cross lighting. They were having trouble getting a cross made that was big enough to get it up and stay up. And so they asked, instead of getting local guys to form security, they got Louis Beam's boys from Texas to go out and be the pickets and guards on the get-together. Now, it was darker than hell. I mean, there were no streetlights out there or anything. And these Texas guys, they didn't know where the hell they were at. They'd never been in the bayou either. And if you know Texas guys, and I know a lot of Texas guys, first thing that happens, they pull a gun and start shooting. So we didn't know it at the time. There was a cop from New Orleans, an overzealous nigger cop, that was not directed to come out there, but he on his own decided to follow us all out there. Well, here's a Texas boy standing out there in the swamp to guard the place, and they hear some limbs cracking as this nigger comes down through the swamp, and they started shooting everywhere. And, of course, the rest of us, we didn't have a radio. We didn't know what the hell was happening. Everybody hit the ground. We're all just hit the ground. And I never will forget the bravery of David Duke, who was there. Duke said, "Burn your membership cards. Put them all in the fire." You know, all that stuff. I said, "Bullshit. I ain't put my membership card in the Klan in the fire." And, well, I knew early on David Duke was a coward. He's always been a physical coward. There's many other situations where he showed to be a physical coward. But here he was. "All you members, throw your membership cards in the fire." Well, anyhow, finally the head guy, the superintendent of the police from New Orleans, came out there and came up to the gate of this place and asked to have a talk. And he said, "Look, I didn't send that guy out here. And let's unwind this thing and unwind it." And we said, "Well, sure. We don't want any trouble. We didn't want to have a shootout." So they backed off. They got their nigger back to New Orleans, and we went on with our little get-together. But it was pretty hairy there for a while. Anyhow, well, let's see. What? Oh, yeah, I think I've gone over the line on the time here again. So that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, another great pagan day. How about that? 14.5. Hope you're getting a lot out of this book, because there's a lot of meat in this book and a lot of training you need to know about, because and benefit by the failures and the mistakes that other people made. Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, for